Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Having trouble getting things done at work? You're not alone. Maybe in order to unlock amazing outcomes, it's time to stop looking up and down for answers and instead start looking across. What do we mean by that? The companies with the fastest speed to market tend to be the ones that look across the organization rather than up and down the hierarchy. Stay tuned to hear how Atlassian software like Confluence, Jira, and Loom can help maximize effective teamwork in your organization. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Support for this episode comes from The Current Report. From data privacy to the future of TV, retail media, and beyond, the world of digital marketing is constantly in flux. So how can you keep up? Well, The Current Report is there for you. Each week, marketing leaders on the cutting edge give you the latest insight. So if it's creating a buzz, they'll be talking about it. Subscribe to The Current Report wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. This is Pivot from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Kara Swisher. Scott Galloway is obviously still recovering from New Year's, and he'll be back next week. But for today, I'm thrilled to have Audie Cornish, the host of CNN's The Assignment, as my co-host. Welcome, Audie.
Hey, Kara. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm in awe of your talent and your various things that you've done over the many years.
I'm a big fan of you because of your interview style specifically. You're like
We both do interviews, right?
You've got a very distinctive style. Not interviewers have their own style.
That's true. And obnoxious. What is it? Like casually cruel. Someone told me I was casually cruel. That's what I was called.
Oh, I don't think that at all. I think I've talked to you about this in the past. Like you have a way of dealing with men the way they deal with women, and it is disarming to them. And then the back and forth, it's like a totally different level. Like, I mean, trust me, like I try and interrupt people sometimes, and the way I have to do it is completely different. And I sit there and listen to you and I'm like, oh my, I want to do it that way. Like,
it's called ball busting. Ball busting is how it used to be. So let me ask you, what is your style? What is your style with this new interview show? What are you hoping for with The Assignment?
The slow boil. No, I mean, I think that Fogs. I like, yeah, exactly. Well, one thing is I'm starting from a place of empathy. Mm-hmm. And not in the corny sense of that word, just the idea of, I realize in a way I'm kind of retraining people how to listen. And if you listen to the first episode, you know, we talk to these school board members, they're conservative activists, and they aren't used to anyone listening.
Right. Which is their thing, which is their grievance, really.
But also, we're not used to listening and to sitting through it and to having follow-up questions that aren't, this is the next question that has to be asked, but you said something, and I want to know what you mean by that. Explain it more. Right. And my goal, in a way, is I don't want people to, what's the phrase? You want people to dislike someone for their best take, not despise them for their worst take.
Right.
I personally believe in a conversation, like in terms of what we do, the idea is for people to give their best.
Yes, I agree with that. Not a bunch of shouting
in their worst argument. You know what I mean? Like that. Right. Who gains from that? So anyway, that's how I think of it.
Is that different at a cable network versus an NPR? Because in NPR, you have that time to roll things out.
You know, it's a very different style. And we tape way more. Live interviews are a totally different ballgame. And you've probably experienced that as well. Mm-hmm. One thing that happens, I think, in a breaking news environment versus an analysis environment or an environment like you're in, there's a heavy emphasis on the turn of the screw, right? So the question of the day is like, will so-and-so get the vote? Instead of being like, why does it matter if they get that vote? What is the greater context? What does it matter to my life if they get that vote? I think that's it. We've not trained ourselves as cable news viewers to want to sit through that level of inquiry.
I think there's a sense of snackable. You know, that's a nice way of saying it. I think it's reductive. I find it super reductive. I have a hard time going on it.
Oh, you do? So tell me about this.
I do lately because it's like, give your idea in 1.2 seconds and you're like, well, it's complicated. Like, you know, when they go Elon Musk, good or bad? And you're like,
That's not how it works. That's not how people work.
Yeah, which is interesting. Are you enjoying it? What's your favorite show so far?
I really love talking to the OnlyFans sex workers because I think that's really at the intersection of a lot of things. The way modern feminism has turned prostitution into labor.
Yep.
And and moved it under the umbrella of labor, something in a way that, you know, a long running movement, but like getting it there because of the way the internet brought so many mainstream people onto it. And hearing them talk about ways they were pushed out of the economy and into this work.
Wow.
You know, one was a nurse. Like, people do this stuff because it's safe in your house, you know, to take off your clothes, safe in your house, theoretically. And interestingly, we did one on journalism, and we had Maggie Haberman from the New York Times. We had Margaret Sullivan, you know, who's a longtime public editor, and Jelani Cobb at Columbia. And everyone... It's a classic episode of The Assignment in that everyone hated it just based on its name and the list of the guests.
Oh, yeah. They're very well, especially Maggie has been in the center of controversy.
But that's kind of the point of the show. It's like, if you want to take the time to listen a little more, it's worth the listen.
Yeah. People do not listen. You're absolutely correct. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I believe in people. When I started this show, and then let's get to the news in a second, but when I started the show, they were like, you have to make it shorter. And I said, I trust people can listen. I honestly, substance is what people are dying for.
Exactly.
What they're not dying for is these like reductive bullshit takes, and they're tired of it, and you're making them stupider. So,
and trust is built. You've built trust, right? Like you have built trust over the years. And so people, when they turn on your podcast, we're here to spend time with you, right?
Right.
And experience your point of view and way of the world. No, it is. I mean, I'm not listening to any random, oh, tech sounds good. Like, I want to hear your take. And I think I've learned to embrace that, because I think before I thought that that was a kind of like branding and self aggrandizing. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, no one wants to spend time with me. They'd be like, you should have a newsletter.
Right.
And I would be like, what?
Right.
Who cares? Who cares what I
think?
No,
we care what you think, Audie. Anyway, I tuned out on the news for a few weeks because I had heart surgery. And so I just turned everything off, which was fantastic.
Well, congratulations, because you're standing, heart beating, looking good.
Oh, it was a minor surgery. It was fascinating because many years ago, I talked about this already, it would have been open heart surgery, but now it went through my leg. I was out of the building that afternoon. It was crazy.
Incredible.
And I have a cyborg heart, which is great, which I'm excited about. Yeah. So I really am paying attention because the news is back again, really, in a lot of ways. And the Republicans today, we're going to talk about the Republicans can't elect a leader. We'll talk about the mess in Congress, what it means for legislation. Also, the European Union makes Meta feel the brunt of their tech regulations. And we'll hear from a listener about media bias, which I think this is great for you to be here to talk about this.
Perfect.
But first, another one of Sam Bankman-Fried's former allies is cooperating with investigators, something Scott and I said would happen. Obviously, everyone's dropping a dime on SBF, the company's top lawyer, providing details about what was done with customer funds, basically stolen, it sounds like. Bankman-Fried is set to go on trial in October and could face up to 115 years if convicted after pleading not guilty to 8 counts of criminal charges. He's currently out on $250 million bail, which is a lot. His co-founder, Gary Wang, and Alameda Research CEO, Carolyn Ellison, are both cooperating with prosecutors. Any thoughts on this? Like, what's happening here? It seems like he's going to jail. It seems like he's on a quicker ride than Elizabeth Holmes, but that's where he's headed.
Well, it doesn't help that he gave a round of interviews on the way there, right? Effectively, like no one asked you to say anything. But it probably speaks to the Icarus nature, you know, of this particular story and the hubris involved, right? If you actually start to believe your own press, and if you actually start to believe that you are sort of philosophically doing some good, even as you're very clearly doing something that is not good, that's going to come back and bite you, you know, in this phase of things. My question going ahead is, how many more people will be charged? I just don't believe that one person did all this. A lot of people signed checks. A lot of people moved the period on zeros. And a lot of people operated in his fear. And I'm curious to hear how it all worked, so to speak, right?
Well, they're all dime dropping. That's what they're doing.
Exactly.
They're going for, like, Carolyn Ellison's right in the up in the middle of this, and I assume they're giving her a certain thing. Same thing with Gary Wang.
I want the full picture, you know, especially because I think it'll help us understand better what to look for in the future with these exchanges. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way this a digital currency can mainstream the way its proponents want. If it still feels like a financial instrument and a toy.
I just interviewed Tony Fadell, who was actually the creator of the iPod, and he's been doing a lot of crypto wallets and stuff. And he still feels it's still a viable industry in certain ways as a way to do identity and move anything from contracts to money to whatever. In this case, I think this is just a simple case of a liar. And I think this idea that he thinks he was going to do the world good, I think he was very cynically went around and gave money to politicians and media and did this whole altruistic whatever.
Yes.
Charity, whatever the fuck. I never could understand
the it. The bros will like, come what? At me, but I definitely, it felt like a scam. It felt like the plot of Glass Onion. It's just like.
Yeah, the Glass Onion. Did you see
just
that?
The Glass Onion billionaire, you know. But we're seeing more of this archetype in pop culture, which I only mention because the movies, et cetera, are art. That's where we start to paint a picture about how we really feel about certain figures in our culture. And the billionaire is taking a hit right now, not just as like the nasty guy or something like that, but as a BS artist. And I think that is a very interesting development culturally, and it does have effects for something like crypto, right? Because now it's got to overcome this sort of public distrust. And it needs the public, because if it wants to be decentralized, like, we all have to sign on to it.
Right. 100%. We'll see what happens here. I think he's going to jail. I don't see how he doesn't go to jail.
Yeah, for sure. So why not?
He's made off over and over. It's the same story.
And it's also very straightforward. And I think it's a good lesson for the crypto world, because if you want to play the big boy finance game, then you also have to play by some rules, too, because all this is done before. You know, there were runs on banks. We had the Great Depression. Like, it's not as though we don't know how currency can work and how it can fail. And you don't defy the laws of gravity.
What was interesting, he was trying for legislation. He was, you know, saying, oh, please legislate. He was one of the few, which is why politicians were attracted to him.
Was he, or was he using it as an excuse to make donations?
Yes, that's correct. They're so easy. They're so absolutely easy to deal with, these regulators. Well. Speaking of Glass Onion billionaire, it actually, Ed Norton played that part in a very funny movie.
Brilliantly. Really,
Janelle Monáe was fantastic. Everyone was great in that movie, actually, I might say.
Which have you noticed there's a bunch of people who hate that movie?
Why? Yes, I know it's Ben Shapiro, so that means it's fantastic. So I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
it was great.
Funny.
I did watch it because I'm open minded. I'm like, okay, didn't like it. Why? It was great. I thought it was great. I don't know. I don't know if you did or not. I thought it was
very funny. I didn't care for the first one because I didn't get it. I was like, Daniel Craig doing this accent. Like, what is this? And then the second one, for some reason, appealed to me more. Maybe because it was much more. You're in on the joke of like, okay, this is just Clue the movie, and the journey's the destination, and just have fun, and it's a good, well executed thing for what it is, and I think that's good after a decade of like puzzle box anti-hero pop culture entertainments, you know, like Westworld or like Breaking Bad or whatever.
Oh, I can't watch that. I cannot.
I think everyone's just like, I just want to see something that has a beginning, middle, and end. And it's just amusing. Yeah.
It was a romp. It was a very funny romp. You know, speaking of the Glass Onion Billionaire, he was actually based, Ed Norton based it on Elon Musk, that's obviously. And he's off to a rough start this year. He's become the first person ever to raise $200 billion from his net worth, which is a lot of money. Fidelity's value of his stake in Twitter is down by 56%. I think that's being kind also. That's after recent drops in Tesla stock, including 11% drop on Tuesday after deliveries fell short. That's been down even higher. The Tesla stock dropped 65% in total in 2022 due to production disruptions, concerns around demand, and of course, Elon Musk's Twitter distraction. What do you think about that? I don't think we've ever talked about it. What is your take on what's going to happen next?
No, we haven't. I mean, it's funny watching mythologies because I do feel like the tech industry of one of just true self-mythologizing. Mm-hmm. It's just key to the whole enterprise. Watching those break down in real time. And these are a lot of self-owns, you know, as the young say. Like, nothing that has happened to Elon Musk in the last 6 months had to happen to Elon Musk.
No, nothing. Nothing. No, he did it himself.
Yeah, every single part of it. Even, let's face it, Mark Zuckerberg and Meta, like, that is nothing. None of that had to happen at the scale it did, at the speed it did, in the way it did.
Right.
And the faltering of it is just, you know, it happens. It's a cell phone.
Yeah. Someone asked me just recently why, you know, I had been, I'm not a fan of Elon Musk. I was very impressed with Tesla, what he was doing at Tesla and what he was making. And it's obviously several years ahead of other car makers. So everybody's catching up. And the SpaceX stuff is impressive. And someone's like, what's your name? I'm like, he changed rather quickly. And he sort of showed some a fake side of himself that's really unattractive. Now, we had covered the issues, the allegations of racism at the factories.
Yeah, don't you feel like this was always there?
It's there. Yes, exactly. We, you know, he and I got into a big beef about COVID. When I was in, he tried to walk out on an interview when I said he was wrong about COVID because he was sort of being very cavalier and saying it was going to go away. And he was forcing people into work and driving regulators crazy around that. And yes, it's sort of one of the people I interviewed said he was 90% fine and 10% kind of crazy like this. And now that crazy part is taken over.
I suspect that ratio was a little, that was a generous ratio.
Well, this was someone who worked with him.
I think it's different when you run a private company and you are self-contained and no one really knows what you're doing. I mean, let's be honest. Like, I know everyone has their mythologies about how Teslas were made and the production and it was bad at first and then it was good. And instead of really talking about what it means to get to that point.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that Twitter is the thing that has undermined him because it speaks to the like oddball nature of this media slash public infrastructure slash private forum company. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you can't make Twitter in private because you, me, we're the creators. We're making the car. So you can't tell us to sleep in the office. You can't tell us to do any of this stuff. And as it turned out, he couldn't even tell the employees really to do that. So he weirdly met his match with media.
Are you using it a lot less? Are you a heavy user of Twitter?
I was a heavy user when I very first started covering Congress because it was a little quieter and smaller then, and it was almost like a second newsroom. We can talk about that later because I think that is a huge issue in terms of media bias. Later on, I realized like, oh, this is a toxic nightmare, but this is where you can spread word about your stories. This is where you can be in a dialogue about the news of the day and that there's value in that. And I especially love the way a whole raft of commentators who could never come up writing a column at a newspaper or whatever were suddenly
there. Right.
They were writers. You know, we can hear from a Jelani Cobb or a Zerlina Maxwell or a Wes Lowry or a Roxane Gay who never, you know, where would she be without this weird platform that just sort of rocketed her to the public consciousness? And even the way it opened up the dialogue for Black and brown communities. I mean, I have thoughts about the obligatory Black Twitter weekend clickbait story that most news organizations default to now. But what it means is instead of some old editor being like, you should go to a barber shop. Like,
yeah,
what do the Blacks think? Like, tick, tick, tick. Let's call this church.
Did you ever have an editor that said that to you?
Yeah, you have to. Oh, the Obama campaign? That is how we were all treated as marginalized groups. It was like, you need to do a Black voter story. You're going to go to a church. Yeah. You're going to go to a barbershop. And if you get spicy, you're going to go to a hair salon.
Oh,
and your editor with a straight face would assign you something like this.
Oh, no.
And now it could be like, or you could kind of like hear this dialogue happening very publicly, hear the factions. Anyway, I'm ranting, but I think it had its use. It was a private-public partnership. And once the private part, as we saw with Elon, took over, it's done. Yeah. That equilibrium was really thrown off.
Yeah, I feel that. I wasn't on it for weeks. Except for in a very small way. It's crazy. And I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine. I feel like I have a lot more time for sure. But you're right. It was a newsroom. We'll get to that in a second because I've actually used it more for this Kevin McCarthy thing.
Yes.
We'll see what happens to it. Lastly, a lot of tech layoffs. Amazon will cut over 18,000 jobs. It had hired like crazy. They had previously announced 10,000 job cuts. It's the largest tech layoff.
I'm obsessed with this story. Not just them, but yes, you said layoffs in general.
Yeah. Right. Salesforce is cutting 10% of its staff, which is around 8,000 people, cutting back on office space. They just had this huge tower in San Francisco they built right before this all happened. A listener wrote us this morning. She said her wife was laid off at Salesforce this week and took a day of emailing up the managerial chain to get clearance about what was going on. She went on to say, people speak highly of Mark Benioff when it comes to being good and empathetic leader. I can attest to that as our family has gained a lot from Salesforce fertility and same-sex parent benefits. But the current change in C-level leadership and poorly executed layoff is Salesforce facing something more than just an economic downturn. It seems like there's something going on with leadership. There is. By the way, Salesforce is a sponsor, but it's really, we've talked about this quite a bit, like with Bret Taylor leaving and others leaving. There's something going on there. And all these companies are really seeing economic contractions affect them, which never did with tech companies. They were able to hire like crazy. Amazon hired 500,000 people during the pandemic, 1 year, I think.
Yeah.
2021. Why are you fascinated with it?
Because during the pandemic, the quarantines led to a bunch of consumer behavior that people mm-hmm. mistook for long-term behavior. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. and obviously I've experienced this, right, entering the streaming world. It was like never-ending growth. There's only more subscribers. There's only more people who are going to want to go into the Meta Mall. There's only more right. people who are going to want to order on Amazon.
TM? Like, is that your name? Meta Mall?
Hey, but go ahead. Exactly. Okay. It was just like, I don't know. People actually sat in boardrooms and were like, this is how we're going to live now, which I understand. There were moments of the pandemic mm-hmm. where I was like, I guess I'm going to be in my house with a baby. Like, mm-hmm. we're mm-hmm. never going to leave the house. Mm-hmm. And then when we didn't leave the house, once the quarantines ended, mm-hmm. I've been a little surprised at how these companies have been shocked mm-hmm. that things have changed for them. And I've been a little disappointed that the media has conflated these really high flyers and their, frankly, readjustment to reality mm-hmm. with the economy as a whole.
Right.
Because people do have jobs. People's wages mm-hmm. are better. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that like a company that hired as much as Amazon did having to mm-hmm. contract is a sign mm-hmm. that the whole economy is bad. Like, it's just a sign that I left my house. And I buy things at
the store.
Although
I do think people did start to do practices that they didn't do. I definitely use delivery more than I used
Absolutely.
To. And
but clearly
I definitely,
not as much, right?
No, not as
Amazon
much. No,
like,
right.
Layoffs.
But I definitely do less office stuff. I think it accelerated trends that were happening anyway, and now it's starting to shake out.
It accelerated trends, but it also minted billionaires. And pushed some companies into places that were not sustainable.
Yeah. No, they
I mean, that's I'm not some socialist.
Their profits were so big. Yeah.
But it's just like, No, I'm just saying, like, I'm not some, you know, progressive socialist here. It's just like, mm-hmm. no, like, you're not, there's only so many people in the country.
Yeah. Well, we'll see where it goes. They're not used to this. The numbers are crazy. The stocks are off like by massive amounts, anywhere from, you know, Microsoft, I think, is in the 20s to 80% for Snapchat.
But the stock market is not the economy. And I think I spend a lot of times when I talk to people, just as a journalist, I have to say, like, let's be clear, you know, like, obviously they are linked, but they are not mm-hmm. one and the same. And it's very easy for the news cycle the business news cycle to tell mm-hmm. regular Americans that things are going sideways. And it's not, it's maybe wobbly, but it's not fully sideways.
Right, exactly. Speaking of, let's get to our first big story. Is the House of Representatives the government? That's the question. And it doesn't seem to be.
The House doesn't exist. Yeah, one third of our constitutional democracy
is offline.
Taking a break.
Like a used Toyota Corolla, the U.S. House of Representatives still lacks a speaker. As we record this, the House has voted 6 times. They may have voted a 7th while we're sitting here. No, they meet at noon. That's
no,
right.
They've got
Kevin McCarthy's
to go.
Vote is shrinking. He started with 203 votes from fellow Republicans and dropped to 201. Even if they elect a speaker after we finish this episode, the chaos still matters. So let's talk about it. You covered Congress. Just tell us, what is going on here? This seems chaotic. And all it is people showing pizzas being brought in. And I'm tired of the pizza discussion.
Pizza
they kept
shots.
Doing, look, there's pizzas. Like, this,
yeah.
Can you give us some
That's
news?
That's really
and not
a
the
sign
news?
That all the journalists are hungry. So
yeah,
it's like
okay,
a camera
great.
Guy being like, when am I cut?
I don't care. So what is going on here? Give us an overview of what you know, this sort of chaos caucus, the Freedom Caucus, and
exactly.
what's going on. And McCarthy keeps giving in to them.
In a nutshell, just in terms of the McCarthy story itself, mm-hmm. essentially after the House majority went to Republicans, they mm-hmm. were victorious. But of course, it was only by a handful of votes. And
right.
that means that all kinds of things were going to be difficult, or you'd have mm-hmm. to get Democrats to sign on, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
mm-hmm.
that conversation was already brewing. But in the background and in the meantime, you had not all of it, but some core members of what is known as the House Freedom Caucus mm-hmm. who were starting to say, this is our chance because the mm-hmm. margin is so narrow. We
right.
will have leverage to
as a small group.
Ask for things. And the reason why I'm saying as a small group is because it's 5 or 6 people who are like never Kevins, they call themselves.
Yeah.
And then there's like 1 or 2 who kind of yesterday were like, I'm tired.
Like,
I'm just going to vote for paid. Yeah.
Because next week they don't get paid. They don't get paid next week, but go ahead.
Exactly. No one does, by the way. Like, I think the whole Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Never mind that there aren't security briefings going on right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Never mind that anyone who tells you they're a congressman right now is like technically wrong because they mm-hmm. haven't been sworn in.
Mm-hmm.
They are, like I said, a massive self-own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kevin McCarthy, who I've talked about this a lot, has watched every major Republican leader of the last 20 years go down in flames. So
mm-hmm.
Gingrich, Boehner, Paul Ryan, I'm going to count mm-hmm. Eric Cantor as majority leader.
Sure.
Every one of these people were felled by the early iterations of what we now call Trumpism, but mm-hmm. obviously came to the public's consciousness with the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he would be the guy to
right.
wrangle them, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? Like, he would genuflect mm-hmm. to Trump enough, he would build those relationships enough, and he would make them happy. So even though he was a hardcore establishment guy, and by that mm-hmm. I mean one of the group of young guns, they called themselves, of which Paul mm-hmm. Ryan, et cetera, were part of it. They were going to be a new generation of hotshot Republicans.
Yeah.
And now they're down to this one pea shooter. You know what I mean? They're like, I don't want this one guy.
What's interesting is I'm watching a little bit of Twitter and other places. They're calling him like Rhino, although Fox News is backing him, which is interesting, you know, and
yes.
yelling at the little
yeah.
group of
I've been
of
joking
the chaos
that
cop.
Fox News is now the Kevin McCarthy of right-wing
yeah.
media, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So what happens here? I mean, the dynamics of this small group, it seems to me like I know Stephanie Ruhle interviewed Lauren Boebert. If you haven't seen it, it's hysterical. Just
it was
for Stephanie's
amazing.
Facial expressions.
Watched it live.
Today, you're backing Byron Donalds as speaker. He's got 20 votes. You think that guy's getting to 218 tomorrow?
I know that there are many of our colleagues who are cheering us on silently and
silently
voting for
won't
Kevin
help,
McCarthy.
Ma'am. 218
votes. We're going to get there.
It was like I
it
took
was incredible.
And
it was
sent
incredible.
Them to her in
yeah.
real time. I'm like, what the fuck? Derp. Like, all the different expressions. Derg, blerg. And so she was nonsensical. Like, I don't understand what she was saying in half the time. But what I did come away with was like, they don't care. They don't care that they're making trouble. And they can continue to make trouble, even though there's more than two, you know, he doesn't have enough votes, but he has a lot of votes, right? But this small group of people can keep him out of office, which presents all kinds of opportunities in lots of ways. Does he have any other choice but to continue to give in? Because he'll anger the rest of the caucus, right? Because they're mad too, but they're not going to, they're going to keep voting for him no matter what.
I mean, I think the history you have to remember for all these people is, and as a country, we went through this before. 2015, mm-hmm. kind of 2014, the government shutdowns, these mm-hmm. like weird precipice votes where mm-hmm. all of these people who claim to be fiscal hawks would say, we can't spend this amount of money. Mm-hmm. We can't raise the debt ceiling so the government can spend more. We can't. And it was like mm-hmm. a personality, you know, it was a whole identity. Then Trump comes along and they're like, well, actually, maybe fine. And, you know, Mark Meadows, who had been in the House Freedom Caucus, becomes a key part of the Trump orbit, et cetera, mm-hmm. Mick Mulvaney. A lot of these people who were part of this mm-hmm. founding, Ron DeSantis, mm-hmm. came out of the House Freedom Caucus, okay?
Right.
It is a political identity. And mm-hmm. I think they're fighting for their survival a little bit after Trump's faltering with the midterms. And by that, I mean the Trump brand is dinged.
Mm-hmm.
Through a variety of reasons, right?
Yeah.
But now the rubber has met the road through the ballot.
Voting, right.
Through voting. And there are a couple more Trump-backed candidates that would have been in the House, right? Like if the red wave materialized, that weren't. And so I think now these people are in the House, they're realizing like, oh, well, wait a second. The tide could be turning a little bit.
This is our last chance.
We gotta solidify our power where we can. So they're arguing ostensibly for these rules changes, and they want to have more participation and blah blah blah. But also note, they want specific committee assignments, right? Assignments that will be helpful and powerful for them. They also have asked the leadership to not jump in on future election and future races that are open. Safe Republican seats. So translation, the next time a Republican seat is open and safe, don't get in there because we know that if one of our guys get in there, there's a good chance a Trumpist will win that primary vote and that person is the person who will advance. Whereas if you jump in and bring in your moderate or bring in your whatever, your establishment and come talk about election deniers, our numbers will be smaller. So there is a way that they're kind of, there's an existential conversation that is buried underneath pizza boxes.
That's a really smart analysis. So what will happen, though?
What will happen is Kevin McCarthy wants to wait them out.
I mean, all the clowns, essentially, Matt Gaetz. Yeah. And then you have Marjorie Taylor Greene against them, which is sort of like, what is happening with this
I don't know. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is going to probably snap into a Slim Jim, right, as we learned from Nancy Pelosi, get his energy up, and he's going to wait them out. Because if there's one thing we have learned from this group over the last couple of years, is they have nothing to lose, and they will wait. Every day that it goes longer is another cable news hit for them. It's another day they can tell a constituent that they stuck it to Kevin and Mitch and the swamp. And that is their gain. That is their reward. So they're they're not like, but what about governing? Like, they're not in it for that. I think there's a way people kind of forget that.
Because there's also this fantasy that Hakeem Jeffries will become speaker, like that six Republicans peel off.
Not a fantasy. I mean, right now, Google in Pennsylvania, this something similar happened, and there's now a like unity speaker. Yeah. So it's possible for people to function like normal human political beings and find a solution. It won't happen here, but just know that an actual model exists right now in the world. I think Kevin is going to absolutely wait it out. He's going to, he's working the phones. There's one or two people he's going to finally peel off. But the problem is, what is it going to take to get there? What do you have to give away to get there? And the other thing about the rules people should understand is by the time you give away so much power, what is the speakership anymore? Is it just symbolic? Because now you've set yourself up where any two or four or one person can raise their hand and challenge your leadership. This puts us in a British situation, you know, where it's no confidence votes and it's this and it's that. And it's like nobody is actually running the thing.
Right. They're always watching their back.
Yes. Yeah. And people need to remember Nancy Pelosi did this. Small majority, challenging group. and look at what she was able to pass.
Yeah.
I mean, it is
so, what's the difference? What is her? I love her. I got to tell you, every time she does a little hit and they, she's like, I don't know. I did it in stilettos. I don't know what to tell you, Kevin.
And backwards, right? Like,
yeah, right,
she did it. And on top of that, Hakeem Jeffries is getting like 3 days of sustained commercial time where people just get up and say how great he is.
Yes,
is
exactly.
He's hilarious.
He said some good quotes himself.
Yeah. Democrats.
So what happens?
Excited.
Where does it end? Because they can't, they don't want to govern too, right? They're also like, we need to actually get in here and do stuff.
Well, yes.
Does that mean chaos for the next 2 years, or does it mean an opportunity for Democrats to get together with Republicans?
Yeah, I think arguably not that much would have happened no matter what. Like, even if he just took over as Speaker and they just went on their merry way, it would just be a lot of investigations into Hunter Biden's laptop and things like that. I don't think you would see a ton of legislation.
ESG investing.
Yes, and I mean, a good way of thinking about this is, where was Mitch McConnell? Well, Mitch McConnell the last couple of days has like been in photo ops with Biden, you know, because he got spending in Kentucky. So he's perfectly capable of getting things done that meet his needs and the through the Senate without the House at all. They effectively took themselves out of the process. I think going forward, there is a chance that another candidate will come forward, or that there's another option, like a Steve Scalise. People have talked a lot about him. And I think the only way you'll know that's happening is if someone gets up and does it kind of without Kevin McCarthy's blessing. Because now, a couple votes in, there are votes that are going to be just about showing everyone in the room where the support is.
Right. But when is the 200 going to say, we're going to someone else? That's who has to do it, right? Not the 20. Or the 20 has got to convince the 200 to come along.
It could. I mean, 200 aren't going to bolt. They just don't like these folks enough, right? Like, Matt Gaetz is not like a popular figure in the House. So there is so much of this that's personality driven. Lauren Boebert, not super popular. And unfortunately for Kevin McCarthy, not super pot, like, they're just people who do not like him. And so I think it does matter what these handful of people choose, because they can also make trouble going down the road. And I think the real question now that Democrats have seen this, how are they going to play the next year or two, right? Like, do they feel like, oh, we got to just stay in line no matter what, because that's where our leverage is? Are there going to be some cinema types, you know, just joking? Like, are there going to be some figures who say, oh, well, I have more leverage to pass things now because the Republicans are so desperate that there's just 5 or 6 votes they need to get something done? I actually think this affects their calculus in a way that they didn't expect. They knew it would be a mess. They didn't know it would be a hot mess.
So give me a prediction, and then we're going to get to our next story about how long it's going to take.
There are no predictions. This is not this. No, it's too many. It's like trying to make a prediction about a room full of cats. Like, which one will come out on top? Like, I don't know, but there's going to be a lot of scratches. Like, I don't know.
Is that an old congressional thing to say?
I just make it up. I just say, like, in politics, we say, no, it's not. I think people need to understand this is unusual, period. This does not happen, period.
Yeah.
But they're so used to hearing us say that coming out of the Trump era that it's hard to grok just how weird this This should have been the easiest vote of the entire year, period. And it's not.
I think they're slowly. I think eventually they'll make progress. I mean, they have to, right? They've been in these talks discussing things.
They've also already shown impatience, you know. And this is one of those stories, no matter what reporters tell you, who are like, my sources say, this is the kind of story where everything is playing out kind of in front of the cameras.
Right?
Yes, because everyone who's complaining is just going out and being like, I'm pissed because of this, I'm pissed because of that, and he needs to give me this and that.
Right. So it's not quiet negotiation.
It's not quiet. Really? I mean, is stuff happening behind closed doors? Sure. But will we see the results of that fairly quickly? Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I would absolutely agree with you. Anyway, let's go on a quick break. We'll see what happens. Good luck, Lauren Boebert. We'll see what goes on with you. When we come back, we'll be talk about how European Union is coming for Meta and take some listener mail.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from Atlassian.
The universal truth with our customers is they're all struggling to get stuff done. Our goal is how do we help them unleash the potential of their people, their teams, and their technology to actually get the right things done at the right time with the right people the right way. And when we do that, magical things truly happen.
Dom Price is Atlassian's work futurist. It's his job to help Atlassian customers imagine more effective ways to work.
It's completely natural to focus on what you can control in your team. The problem is if that's all you do, you get pretty myopic. The best teams I'm working with, they really work on who are the people upstream and downstream that we need to work with. How do we get flow across the organization? How do we get value into the hands of our customers quickly?
And sometimes achieving flow means that instead of asking who do I work for, it's asking who do I work with.
When you get team connection right, everyone benefits, the employee, the employer, and the customer, right? To get stuff done, the best organizations and teams right now are focusing on modern work. They're dreaming about the future, but they're dreaming about it by planting the seed to get the right things done right now.
Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom enable teams to work effectively together to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Audie, we're back with our second big story. The European Union says Meta must pay for privacy violations. Not a surprise. Regulators say that Facebook and Instagram violated the EU's landmark tech regulation, the GDPR. The EU ruled the social network's terms of service forced users to agree to data collection for personalized ads. Now regulators have fined the social networking giant more than $400 million. Meta says it will strongly disagree with it and will appeal. Again, this is Europe now regulating U.S. companies, which the U.S. government, because it's not functioning, has not been able to do for a long, long time.
And wouldn't. They're not at anywhere near where the EU regulatory infrastructure is when it comes to tech, period.
Yeah. When is our Congress going to get in here in the way the GDPR? Now, they may appeal, and the court isn't telling Meta how to fix it, but it is taking the lead on privacy. The two things that are taking the lead are Europe and Apple.
Yeah. I mean, I would love your opinion on this. I think there's a very, very deep connection between the Republican and even just American capitalist sense of, like, protect innovation at all costs.
Yeah.
Versus the European sensibility about these things.
I think they can't get around the European Union. They don't care. They don't, you know, this
oh,
is...
Oh, no, I mean in terms of us ever regulating. Like,
I don't.
Ever,
I mean, look, Amy Klobuchar's bills went nowhere, right? They're sort of sitting there. They were sitting there and didn't pass in this last session.
Or talk to a kid about TikTok being regulated.
Right.
They're
right.
just like, yeah. what? You know, to the right. barricades. Like
that might come sooner because of the Committee on Foreign Relations in the U.S. That may have some teeth to it.
And because
here.
Republicans are very deeply invested in this battle with China. Like it is directly tied into some philosophical underpinnings going on right now. Not so much them being like privacy's important.
Agreed. And I think I think there's no regulation. U.S. is nowhere on this regulation. No. And also, by the way, they're also helping. Donald Trump could get back his Facebook and Instagram accounts. He was banned indefinitely after January 6th, which I never liked indefinite. What is it? Either ban him or don't.
Yeah, there was some sort of cowardice to that.
Meta shortened the ban to 2 years. After the oversight board, they tried to send it over the oversight board. They're like, it's your decision. It's going to be made soon by Nick Clegg, who is not Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Twitter's bringing back political advertising on the platform. Political ads have been banned there since 2019.
Yep.
So they're not going to be regulated in any way, and they're going back to their practices, I think.
Also hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube or whatever, right? Like, they've already entered the political sphere in this way. They've already, they've literally become a place for organizing rebellion movements, right? Like January 6th, that's like a organized on social media.
Facebook,
Yeah, and I think their attempt to sort of say like, well, we're not going to get into the moderating anymore. They've just struggled. They all struggle with this. You know this. They want to be the size of a country, but they don't want to create infrastructure or roads or any or safety. Like, they don't want to do any of that. They just want the money part.
Yeah, and without any government regulation, they're not going to do anything.
Yeah, great great responsibility, all of that.
They don't care.
They don't want it.
This week, anti-vaxxers on Twitter tried to link the collapse of NFL player DeMar Hamlin to COVID vaccine, and no one did anything about it, which was ridiculous, he was hit in the heart. He got whatever it's called.
But that's where I actually feel optimism, because while the places where that conspiracy boil is always simmering, I feel like the rest of us and like kind of more mainstream America and your regular person's Facebook was not so quick to jump on that. And I feel like the last couple of years, we've all been so burned by social media, either by its bosses, right? Like faltering on the philosophy and the image, and or watching what happened with the elections, watching what's happened in some of our own families, where you like try and have a conversation with someone who has educated themselves in online conspiracy patois. Like, we're all different. And I think we're more reluctant now to let these things come to a boil. That's what I hope.
That's interesting.
And that's what I thought coming out of the election, you know, just with the election deniers getting the door slammed in their face.
Right.
It was people being like, I'm tired. Like, I am tired of this.
I would agree.
And I'm done.
I would agree. Although I do think these privacy regulations are critically important, that we have not.
They are.
Antitrust and privacy regulations seem to me to be the lowest bar our government can put in terms of how these companies operate. And
yeah, and I don't want to rely on Apple. I don't want to rely on.
But you do rely on Apple. Apple is who you're relying on to do
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Exactly.
Any over under on Donald Trump getting back Instagram? I think he's getting them back. I think they're going to get them back.
I sort of have bigger questions about what his quote unquote campaign is doing.
Right.
Like,
you can tell us.
Where is he? What is he talking about?
He's
what does
Mar-a-Lago,
he care about?
According to Olivia Nuzzi. He's hanging
out
with Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, but like,
Diet Cokes.
He's on Truth. So, like, he's not even acting like a candidate. He's not even acting like his version of acting like a candidate. Maybe it's all the legal stuff, blah, blah, blah. But he's different. And I can't even answer the social media question is important because it was so key to who. To the building of him as a candidate.
Right.
And with that infrastructure all messy and crumbly, he's struggling.
Yeah.
You know, it really does
prove
how reliant he was on it. I
don't think it matters, not at all. I think putting him off for those 2 years has rendered him less powerful on those platforms.
Yes.
So,
and that's what's so wild about the people who are like, you got to bring him back, and who have made it this free speech cause and everything. It means they looked in the face of January 6th and they said, look, you got to break some eggs.
You
know, for free speech. Like, you just gotta, and it's like, okay, I don't know how to argue with that.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I think they're probably gonna let him on. I don't know what other decision they can make. If Elon Musk had not bought Twitter, they would have not let him on, because why cause any? They just said, we made a decision we threw him off. That's what it is. In this case, calling it indefinite was a problem. Like, they should have either thrown him off or not thrown him off, or given him 2 years and then said, you're back on in 2 years. And if you violate again, we'll kick you off for good. That's something very simple. It's like dealing with kids. It's like dealing like, you know, maybe I'll.
Can I ask you what this decision or others in recent months make you think about the direction for Zuckerberg and him specifically?
He's not interested at all.
Yeah, like, where is he? Is he just, like, exiting?
He's interested in the metaverse. He's not interested in running the real business anymore.
So you're saying he's not of this earth anymore?
Yes, he's not. He's in the metaverse. Yeah, he's tired of it. It's exhausting, and he's not very good at it. And so...
Yeah, but does that mean, like, Trump's in the metaverse? You know what I mean? Like, where does he...
He's trying to make the metaverse happen. We'll see. He's handed a major decision over to someone else. So that's it. You know, he doesn't want to deal with the fallout out of it. So he doesn't want his name next to it.
Yeah.
Sheryl Sandberg's left the building, left the building. And so they're all like, oh, I've had enough of this. And it is exhausting on some level, unless you establish rules from the beginning, like they did at Reddit. Actually, if you want to talk to a smart person, talk to Steve Huffman at Reddit. They changed many years ago because they knew, and he just said, I'm throwing off malevolent players. That's it. Like, he didn't sit and Hamlet the whole thing. He just said, this is our rules. If you like it, great. Yeah. If you don't, you're okay. And there, here's what we're doing. I don't know. Let's pivot to a listener question, though.
You've got. I can't believe I'm going to be a mailman.
You've got mail.
The question comes from Janine DeNoves on Twitter. As a journalist, how does Audie Cornish make sense of the both-sidism that's taken over so much of the press? What do we do, the public who depend on the free press, do? What do you think about that? That's an interesting question.
Well, both-sidism is a very specific critique, I think, that does come from a place of its own political bias. But it is the idea that you present two or three sides of things as co-equals, even if one of them may be immoral or doesn't actually stand up to scrutiny, and that you put them on an equal plane. And I do think that the Trump era really brought that into deep relief, because it was very hard to be like, oh, well, we're not going to have the cabinet member of such and such on, or we're going to, like, if the most, one of the highest advisors gets on and uses the phrase alternative facts, it's like, do you ask an intern to come on? Like, who is the communication voice coming out of the seat of power? Yeah. I think it was very hard to figure out how to do that. And the public didn't love it, you know, especially on the left.
Right. So what do you do?
I mean, I think that there has been a sincere recalibration. You know, I do think that it is much more common for people to just immediately say, oh, this person isn't serious, or this is not a serious conversation, or this is a bad faith argument, or I do think that that is far more aggressive than it used to be. And that makes a big difference. I mean, these are active questions. Like, I don't have an answer for her that's going to satisfy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you, when you think about that, when I think about who I want to interview, someone was, you know, Stephanie had Lauren Boebert, and she did a long, like, this is why I had her, because she's in the middle of this mess, not on the other stuff. I don't know how you can separate them, but I did see her do that. It was really, she did a good job of it for having, you know, Lauren Boebert.
But, yeah, and listen, I do a podcast that is absolutely vulnerable to the criticism of its platforming this or that, right? Like, you're platforming these conservative activists without the other side. You're platforming sex workers without the other side. Like, you know, that was a conscious decision I made to be like, okay, well, what does it look like to create something where you hear an argument out all the way? How much work can I do as an interviewer to make the conversation feel fleshed out and balanced? You know, the show may not be the same format forever, but I think it's part of my own personal reckoning with some of the ideas that people are talking about when they talk about bias.
Right. I have two things. I say what I think, like, so it's not hidden. So it's not as if I'm like trying to be, I'm fair. I'm like, I don't like you. You're nonsensical. And I'll also do what I damn well please. You know what I mean? That's how I say to people when they do the platforming thing at me, you shouldn't plan. I'm like, don't do it on your show. Fine, whatever. Do you have a show? No, you don't. I do. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think I'm sort of like, I'll do who I damn well please, and I'll do a good job. And if you don't like it, don't listen to it. And I think that's what I tend to do. And I do, I do think, like, would I have Marjorie Taylor Greene on? Like, I interviewed Piers Morgan recently, and we both were like, she lies so much. How do you spend a lot of time batting back lies.
At the
same
time,
I heard her speak, and I was like, well, she's clearly intelligent. She's clearly like a sharp political player, even though she lies incessantly. But go ahead. Sorry.
Well, that's probably key to being a sharp political player at this point.
No,
that's a very good question. And I think each journalist has to kind of make that decision for themselves. Like, am I best positioned to service this conversation in a way that's going to enlighten the audience and that is actually going to elicit not just information, but understanding. And there's some interviews you would do that I wouldn't do. There's some interviews I probably would do that you might be like, that's not for me. And I think that's important to understand, too. Sometimes we look at our heroes as journalists, air quotes, and then we're like, why are they doing that?
Yeah, I get a lot of that. Is there anyone who you wouldn't do, who you wouldn't interview? Can you think of someone?
You know, I'm not a fan of the talking to a white supremacist. You know, that's something that I want, in a way, I kind of want white interviewers to pick up that mantle and do it in a way that their predecessors completely failed or, frankly, co-opted. But I don't want to sit down and talk with someone who doesn't believe me or my children should live freely.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
That conversation is a literal non-starter. But for a white interviewer, I think, yes, I want to hear you ask bluntly, why should we live with this privilege and not acknowledge it? Like, what should you know what I mean? Like, what does it mean to talk about reparations without spiraling into some nonsense conversation? Like, there are real things that I think, especially white Americans post the awakening, are capable of dialoguing about that they, like, couldn't, you know, before.
And,
like, they should go do that, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then there are some things that I feel like I can handle more sensitively than I hear some interviewers doing. And that, I don't know. I mean,
is there anything you'd like to do a lot more of where you may not agree with people?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's actually, we're having a pitch meeting in 2 days, and that's for the staff. I've said, listen, you guys are giving me a lot of things you kind of agree with.
Yeah.
And I need you to go down the rabbit hole in some places and with some people that you don't necessarily understand. And again, I said to them, I gave the same example, I don't need a Klan member. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to do any of that. But, like, there are some worlds we need to tap into and better understand, and there are ways that we can bring context to the conversation. That's our job.
That's a really good way of putting it. Here's another email from someone who doesn't share our social media. I'll read it. Love the show, but please recognize that people who've never had any presence on social media do exist, and for the most part, we lead happy, socially well-adjusted lives. I've never had Facebook, Twitter, or an Instagram account. I'm an ER doctor and researcher. I love pop culture and fashion. My husband and I throw a lot of dinner parties. We have a fabulous group of friends and a large, loving family. All of this to say, as one can strive to live the best life and contribute meaningfully to society without social media. My dream is to impart this philosophy to my young children. I know they will only be happier people if they're able to live as social media free. Thanks for all your great work, Roseanne McElroy. Roseanne, come over for dinner at my house.
I know. Well adjusted. I love it. That's a life.
P.S. Rest assured, I engage in many other forms of procrastination. We do recognize that, Roseanne, and we wish we were you. We wish we were you, correct?
I don't think for journalists we need to pretend that social media is a thing we need to abandon completely at all. Like, I think it's been beneficial to journalism to have this ruckus back and forth. Mm-hmm. It's beneficial to see Ben Shapiro's dumb tweets. It's beneficial to know what's being said in the various echo chambers. I think that there is value, though, to the broader public not living in social media in the ways that they do.
Most people are like her.
No, absolutely. But I mean, for the people who are those, like, weird power users, you know how you go on Facebook and there's someone who's posting 10 times a day and you're like, how? I wish somehow I could reframe for people that you're doing free data entry for billionaires. And you are the product. And it's not necessarily doing all the things you think it's doing. And the reason why I don't want to abandon it completely is because so many marginalized communities have benefited from it. You know, people like who are disabled, like people like that. There's, you know, it's the, I kind of joke, the Arab Spring argument. Like, every time we talk about how terrible Twitter is, someone's like, oh, yeah, well, Arab Spring. And you just kind of be like, well, first of all, that didn't work out so great. So we need to be clear that, like, there's difficult things still happening in those countries, right? Like, but it's just the idea that, like, yes, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, that political movements are taking place there and that that's important and significant. But there's a lot of other stuff that I'm not sure is so additive to one's life. And it's
I agree.
Totally okay to embrace that.
Yes, I agree. We think that's great. I do think it is a good news distribution. I think for this this thing in Congress, it's much easier to get the news from a Twitter or a Facebook than it is.
Also, for her, her kids may feel differently and their kids. Like, you, this movement of quiet quitting and I don't like hustle culture and I don't do this and I want to be in a union. Some of that is a rejection of the attention economy and being online all the time as a way of life. And that is, like, Gen Z's all over that. You know, they're just like,
I got to tell you, my kids don't use social media at all. At all. Not even, they took them all off their thing. It's really interesting.
They get it.
My older sons, my sons don't. I think
they get it.
Maybe teen girls are on it a little bit more, some of them. But not interested in TikTok. They watch YouTube a little bit and Reddit, and that's it. It's interesting. I don't know. And the 3-year-old has yet to get a phone, so we'll wait for that one. Goodness. Anyway,
I have a 3-year-old too. Why didn't you do a segment of the show? It's like 3-year-olds. What the hell?
Frozen. Audie, they like Frozen. They continue to like Frozen. That is really...
They're obsessed. And let me tell you, because I'm a streaming household...
How old are your kids?
3 and 5.
Yeah.
They don't really watch TV. They don't get to watch TV. But the profound cultural reach of Disney is so deep and so insidious that just by attending school, they now know the entire soundtrack of Frozen and Encanto.
Encanto is there, but Frozen.
Have you heard your 3-year-old sing Surface Pressure?
I have. I have many times. Hundreds of times.
That's literally a song for like firstborn immigrant daughters. Like I heard that song and I like shed a tear. I was like, I know the truth. And Disney, it's in my house. Marvel's in my house. And even though they have not seen a single one of these films, period.
Yep. Well, I applaud you, but I unfortunately have given in to the Frozen, whatever it is.
No, they watch stuff, but just like they haven't seen that stuff, but they know it all. Yeah. It's very weird.
They know it all. And also Taylor Swift. That's what I would say.
Yep, and they know how to use my device, right? Like they can get onto your phone.
It's the Frozen Taylor Swift pincher. My daughter was singing Anti-Hero the other day. She's 3 years old.
Oh, my God. You know you're old when your kid shows you how to use your device? Because I didn't think I was very old. And then they were like, no, swipe this way. And I was like, oh, it's happened. It just happened. That's it. Gray hairs come out now.
Anyway, these are great questions. We like them. We really enjoy them. If you got a question of your own and you'd like answered, send it our way. Go to nymag.com/pivot to submit a question for the show or call 855-51-PIVOT. All right, Audie, one more quick break. We'll be back for wins and fails.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
Okay, Audie, let's hear your wins and fails. I'm going to give this sole segment to you.
Obviously, number one fails still Kevin McCarthy. I can't help it. It's just the biggest first New Year fail. That was, you know, for no reason. You know, wins. I'm actually not sure about wins. Who's winning right now? I mean, Joe Biden looks pretty comfortable. He's like a president who's passed a lot of legislation. He will have earned the legacy of being the vice president to the first Black American and having a Black American vice president of his own. He's just going to be in the history books in a bunch of different ways. And I think that people underestimated him at their own peril, especially Republicans. And he's now going to the border for the next day or two, which is exactly what Republicans said they wanted, but they can't capitalize on it because every single camera will be on Kevin McCarthy's pizza boxes. So not to be a political hack, but this one is just too big not to comment on in terms of wins and fails.
I think you're right. I think Biden is always underestimated in
kicking off the year.
Yeah, I think him being in a limo with McConnell and DeWine and very successful, and everyone's like, "Well, that's
the
what
aviators
we want.
Were back." It was the full. Yeah. He felt
the full
good.
Biden. Yeah. He felt good. He's looking good. He's feeling good. It's interesting. You know, I have a theory, and I'd like it to put it out on you. Years ago, Nancy Pelosi invited me to talk about tech in front of the Democratic caucus, right? They were out at some hotel in Virginia, and they get together, and they all do their thing.
Yeah, they retreat, right.
So I went out, and I talked to them, and it was a good speech, and there was all these moderates, and then there were the left wings. It was really interesting. I took my son at the time. He was maybe 12 or 13 at the time, and he came up to me and he goes, "Mom, these people can't agree on anything." And I was like, "Really?" He goes, "They just argue with each other all the time." He was wandering around and listening to them, right? And I thought, you know what, Alex, this is actually a really good thing. They know how to disagree together. And yeah. and he said it to Pelosi, and she goes, and he goes, I can't believe you keep these people together. And she goes, but I do. And it was really, it was like a loud family. Like, she's Italian, obviously, the loud Italian family.
Italian and my from Baltimore. I always yeah. want people to remember that she's actually yes. a Baltimore politician.
She's a Baltimore, right. And I was like, they know how to disagree with each yeah. other. They're fine with it. It's a mess, but it's a, and I think one of the things that Republicans did, having covered it very briefly when I was at the South section of Washington Post, is they threw the best parties because they all fell into line. Like, the Democratic parties were a mess, right? They were always like all over the place. And I thought, if you're people that fall into line all the time, once you don't know how to disagree together, it's a real problem. Right. Like, you don't know how to get along when you're in disagreement. And that reminds me of that. The Democrats.
What I like
know how
about this argument that you're making mm-hmm. is, for everyone listening, you're going to hear the exact thing that Kara is saying. Only Republicans will say it in the middle of this debacle. Right. Because yeah. they're trying to use that argument mm-hmm. to put some sort of sheen on Mm-mm. this show. Right.
Like, they're basically disagreeing badly. They're disagreeing
yeah,
badly.
So they're going around
they're
being like, oh, democracy
is
messy. This is just what happens. And it's like, no, mm-mm. no, this isn't actually how it works when you have a messy family mm-hmm. disagreement. This isn't yep. actually like recalcitrance is not the most mm-hmm. significant or important part. So if I were you and you're at home watching and you're trying to figure out what's going on, imagine the relative at your Thanksgiving dinner who just won't stop. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. And who just mm-hmm. really at a certain point, you're like, oh, OK, can we eat? That's what's yeah. happening yeah. here. And it's not helpful.
It's not healthy debate, which is always good. Anyway, Audie, thank you so much. That's the show. You can listen to more from Audie on The Assignment every Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. We'll be back on Tuesday for more. I really appreciate it for you to come here. And I urge everyone to listen to your show. And I would love to have you back anytime.
I loved it. I'm a huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
Scott Galloway is a brother in CNN Plus, mm-hmm. RIP. Mm-hmm. He's an alum. Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a good time at CNN.
I heard.
yeah, that's all right. Whatever. Poor Scott. He never gets a TV show. Anyway, with Scott gone, I'm going to read us out. Today's show was produced by Lara Naiman, Evan Engel, and Taylor Griffin. Ernie Enderdot engineered this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Pivot from New York Magazine and Vox Media. We'll be back next week for another breakdown of all things tech and business. And again, Audie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for the show comes from Atlassian. What do you think of when you hear the word flow? How about a smooth river of collaboration culminating in a shared ocean of positive outcomes across your organization? Atlassian software like Loom, Confluence, and Jira can help you achieve maximum flow across your teams by enabling fast and easy communication and connection no matter what time zone they're in. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unlock flow across your teams at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.